Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we go to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology to learn about its counterintelligence project. Scientists there are rethinking the kitchen. They've created talking oven mitts that tell you if the roast is done, and coffee makers that know you like extra milk in your latte. It's the kitchen of the future at MIT. Jane and Michael Stern claim they've found the best homemade ice cream in all of Rhode Island. Master of Wine Mary Ewing Mulligan talks the red wines of Portugal. We hear what it's like to have the editor of Gourmet Magazine over for lunch. And we learn about America's first protected chili pepper. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide for nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. I looked around the kitchen today, and I realized the fruit was closing in. I went nuts at the market as usual, and now there's melons, blackberries, nectarines, peaches, along with these delicious green tomatoes. Now, of course, the big question is, what do you do with all this? Let's face it, the fruit is not going to get better than it is right now and for the next couple of weeks. Now, everybody loves to just eat fruit straight at this time of year. But also, this is the best time for great fruit desserts. So let's go for it. How about a dish that people will tell their friends about? Now, I'm offering this as an idea, so please trust yourself enough to create your own recipe around these basics. There is this sweet pizza that we've been making all summer. The topping changes with whatever fruit we have, but the crust and the filling stay the same. And it has some surprises that always get people buzzing. Now, the filling is fast, it requires no heat, and it tastes like a creamy cheesecake. As the foundation of the pizza, I make a simple pie crust. I roll it really thin, then I spread it on a big pizza pan. You chill that for about an hour, and then you bake it in a hot oven until it's golden. Now, you can use any pie crust recipe here. But I've got a trick that helps keep the crust tender. No matter what the recipe, try this. Mix the dry ingredients in a plastic bag. Cut up the butter or fat into big pieces and add that to the bag. Put them in the freezer for anywhere from 30 minutes to a day or two. Then use the food processor or your fingers to blend the fat with the dry ingredients. There's another trick, too. When you add the liquid to the dough, just toss it with a fork. Don't stir, because that's one of the things that can end up making a tough crust. Now, you do this just until everything is kind of moistened. The dough is going to look like a crumbly mess, and that's fine. What you do is, to know if it's right, is you try to squish it together with your hands. If it holds itself in a ball, there's enough moisture in the dough. If it crumbles apart, sprinkle it with a little bit more liquid, toss it, and then try to make that ball again. Roll the dough out on a generously floured surface, spread it on a buttered 14 or 16-inch pizza pan, and then chill it for about an hour or overnight. And then you bake it however the recipe tells you to. Now, the cheesecake filling is easy. You whip about a cup of heavy cream with sugar and vanilla to taste. I do this in the food processor. Once the cream is whipped, you put it in the refrigerator. Now you take a pound of cream cheese and you put that in the food processor with lemon juice. I use about the juice of a whole large lemon and lemon zest. Again, I use all the zest from that lemon. Then you add sugar and vanilla to taste. What you do is puree it in the food processor, but keep tasting. What you want is a mixture that tastes a little lemony and is sweet enough that you really like the flavor, but it's not cloying. Fold that mixture into the whipped cream and chill it. It'll hold for about 2 days. Now, to assemble the tart, spread the filling over that baked crust and top it with chunks of fruit, like big cubes of cantaloupes or peaches, and then stud the whole tart with something like blackberries. Now just imagine how dramatic that's going to look. The idea is you use the best tasting fruit that you can get in whatever combination you think you're going to like. Now, for a tart contrast, try a little diced green tomato. Remember, it is a fruit, and trust me, it sets off the other fruits beautifully. But now for the big finish. This is the conversation piece. Top that pizza with torn up mint, basil, some black pepper, a sprinkle of salt, and a generous amount of sugar, and serve it up. And join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where you'll find an exclusive selection of Corningware bakeware, including the classic white French line. Corningware can go from the freezer to the oven to the dinner table. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI Public Radio International. Well, today we have some counterintelligence, a project at MIT's Media Laboratory where scientists are working on futuristic kitchens. Researcher Joseph Kay joins us to explain what the kitchen of the future may be like. How about countertops that remind you how you improvised that soup last week, and a switch that turns on the light while it releases the aromas of that gingerbread that your mom made when you were a kid? Master of Wine Mary Ewing Mulligan is back from Portugal, where she discovered a renaissance in winemaking. Evidently, the reds are delicious and they're undervalued. You know how nervous you get when you have someone you don't know over for a meal? Well, imagine how Scott Haas felt when he entertained Ruth Reichel. Ruth is editor of Gourmet Magazine. If that's not enough, before that, she was one of the most powerful restaurant critics in the country. Scott has lived to tell the tale. We have a report on America's first protected chili pepper. Then, as always, we open the lines for your calls in the second half of the show. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's get everything rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Two for the Road column in Gourmet Magazine. Okay, you two, what's the latest find?
Well, we've been traveling in our favorite state, Rhode Island, weirdest, littlest state in America that has the strangest foods, has the best regional accents, and has my new favorite place to eat, Gray's Ice Cream in Tiverton, Rhode Island.
My name is Ann Costa, and we're at Gray's Ice Cream in Tiverton, Rhode Island.
And what is Gray's known for?
Best homemade ice cream in the state of Rhode Island.
Are there any particular flavors that people come here for?
The best-selling flavor is coffee, followed by vanilla, chocolate, and mocha chip.
Now, I also noticed there are some flavors that I don't see on a lot of menus around the country. I think you know what I mean.
I think that possibly Gray's is the only ice cream manufacturer that is making ginger anymore. Ginger is a very expensive ice cream to make, and it's not made with flavoring. It's made with real ginger root.
What about grape nuts ice cream? Tell me about that.
Oh, that's the breakfast of champions, grape nut ice cream. It's just a base with grape nut cereal in it.
Now, here's what I really came to find out. If I come here and say, give me a milkshake, what would I get?
A milkshake is different to people from different areas. Now, if you came in and asked me for a milkshake, I would hope that someone would ask you whether you wanted ice cream in it. Because in this area, a milkshake, to us, is just coffee syrup and milk, or vanilla syrup and milk, and put on a blender without any ice cream.
You know, that's something that brings back memories, because I think if you don't live or you've never been to the Northeast, first of all, you never hear, guys, the correct pronunciation of the word coffee.
Coffee?
Yeah, coffee. And I grew up with that. But the other idea that milkshake is a shaken milk.
Exactly. Well, the other thing is that if you want what the rest of the world knows as a milkshake, what you ask for, and I don't know how this ever came to be, is a cabinet. A cabinet always includes the ice cream, the syrup, and the milk.
Huh. Tell me about the ginger ice cream.
Okay, Lynn, you're really turning me on now. I have to tell you that I am a very loyal person. As you know, Michael and I have been married for 30 years. We have, you know, very sort of monogamous habits, but I have decided that I am a complete vixen when it comes to ice cream, because I used to love, and it's still, I think my second favorite ice cream in the world is Dr. Mike's chocolate lace ice cream in Bethel, Connecticut. My new favorite is Gray's ginger ice cream, because it is not just ginger flavored. They actually use pieces of ginger root chopped up and pulverized into this creamy vanilla base. It's probably the greatest thing I've ever tasted.
And if you think the ice cream is good, get that ice cream as the basis for a hot fudge sundae, because enrobed in dark hot chocolate, the ginger ice cream makes for a combination that it really leaves me kind of speechless.
Oh, that sounds really, really good.
I mean, Gray's has been making ice cream since 1923, and, you know, it's the kind of place you just drive by, and there's nothing spectacular looking about it at all, except maybe for the fact that you see some kind of wonderful llamas that are owned by Miss Dennis out to the side, sort of munching on alfalfa and hay. She said they don't care for ice cream at all, which just shows you what a llama's palate is like, but it is absolutely worth a trip to Tiverton, which is probably one of the prettiest areas in the country. Ask for a cabinet, a frap, coffee, milk. It's weird language, weird territory, and the best ice cream in America.
I'm ready to go, guys. And also coffee ice cream.
Coffee.
I love.
Let's
I
coffee
love.
Up.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Hey, you two. Thank you.
Bye.
I'm your ice cream man. Stop me when I'm passing by. I'm your ice cream man. Stop me when I'm passing by. I school your little girl to guarantee I'm satisfied.
Gene and Michael Stern are authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA. Every week you can hear them here on The Splendid Table, and every week you can get their food finds on our website at splendidtable.org. Mary Ewing Mulligan was the first woman in America to earn the prestigious Master of Wine title. Now, this is akin to a PhD in wine. Mary always has some new discovery for us. Hey, Mary, welcome.
Nice to be here, Lynn.
Mary, years ago, I remember drinking wines from Portugal. Now, what I remember is Matus, the rosé.
As do I.
Yeah, but you never hear about wines from Portugal these days.
Well, you know, Portugal has had a sort of a flash in the pan success in this country back in the 1970s with the Matus Rosé and also Lancer's Rosé, Lancer's White.
Right,
they
yeah.
were very popular for a little while. And, of course, what is the current popularity of Portugal is port wines, and, of course, especially connoisseurs know vintage port. It's such a wonderful wine. It's sweet, fortified wine. It's a great collectible, great auction item. But you're right that the table wines of Portugal just somehow never got off the ground. But I think that's changing.
So what is out there? I mean, is there anything out there for us to try, or is it just not coming into the country?
Oh, you know, as a matter of fact, there is so much out there that it's confusing. And one of the handicaps that Portugal has always had in terms of its wines is that most Portuguese grapes are native Portuguese grapes. And I actually think this is a good thing. I mean, it's confusing for us as consumers because we never heard of Tintoriche, or we never heard of Torriga Francesa or Trincadeira and these grape varieties like this. But I think it's wonderful that in the new vitality that Portuguese table wines are having, that they're keeping their old grape varieties. Let me just tell you what's going on. Portugal joined the European Union in 1986, and that was sort of the beginning of the new age of Portuguese wine. Of course, everything is happening very slowly because nothing happens overnight in the wine business ever, or the grape growing business.
Mm-hmm.
So since 1986, Portugal had access to European Union funds. And Portugal is actually the second poorest country in the European Union after Greece. So a lot of those funds were available to Portugal in terms of wine, for replanting vineyards, for building new wineries, for modernizing wineries. And it sort of got the whole ball rolling. Now there are new winemakers who are very energetic and very excited. There's a new way of looking at wines. There's a new quality to the wines. The wines are fresher and fruitier than they used to be. The good news is that they're still Portuguese wines because they're still made from these native grape varieties. And secondly, that they sell at very, very affordable prices. You can find tons of good Portuguese wines under $10 a bottle, and even more if you go up to $15 a bottle. Very high quality because they're undiscovered.
Well, can you give me some examples?
Well, sure. Actually, at the moment, I'm taken with the wines of the Douro. This is a particularly interesting story because the Douro Valley is where the grapes for port grow. So in the exact same geographic area, the same vineyards, the same grape varieties, the producers are entitled to make table wines instead of port. And it used to be that they made table wines sort of with the leftover grapes that they didn't use for port, and they would just make some wines for local consumption.
Mm-hmm.
But now they're making really fine quality. And, of course, in 5 years' time, they will be even finer, and there will be even more producers making fine quality. I recently visited a couple of producers that I thought were really top-notch. I just loved this small winery called Quinto do Vale Dona Maria. And of all things, there's a woman winemaker there named Sandra. She's from Lisbon, and the port zone or the Douro Valley is a very traditional area, and it was sort of startling to see a female winemaker there. But she's making some wonderful wines, only starting about 2 or 3 years ago to make table wines. It's just a wonderful property. I also love the wines from a property called Quinto do Valado. And also, of course, Quinto do Crasto. This third one, Quinto do Crasto, is probably somewhat more available across the U.S. than the other two are, but the other two are definitely available as well. And all three of them are very fine.
Mary, are these reds or whites?
Well, these are mainly reds. There are white wines made in the Douro Valley,
mm-hmm.
and the white wines can be good, but the action really is in red wines, full-bodied, rich, richly textured, dry red wines.
Hmm. Some more examples.
Well, the other area that's really coming on strong, it's completely different from the Douro because it's not mountainous, it's not as old-fashioned, it's called the Alentejo, and it's in southeastern Portugal. In fact, it occupies about half of Portugal's border with Spain, and it makes about half white wines, half red wines, but the new emphasis, again, is on the red wines because it's a warm area as far as its climate. And the vineyards are being replanted, and there are some wonderful wines and wineries there, a wonderful winemaker. I met this fellow named João Portugal Ramos, and apart from the fact that I love his name, I think it's so ironic that his name has the word Portugal in it, he's a real cheerleader for the wines of the Alentejo. He's just a brilliant, magnetic, inspirational figure for all of Portugal as a winemaker. He was a consulting winemaker in Portugal for 20 years and settled down in the Alentejo because this was the area where he felt the best grapes were going to grow and the best wines were going to be made. So his winery is named after himself. And there's another winery called Quinto do Carmo, which is actually approximately half owned by Chateau Lafite of Bordeaux, but very much making Portuguese-style wines, not trying to make French wines. Both wineries are using native Portuguese grapes, making Portuguese wines.
Mary, thank you.
You're welcome.
Mary Ewing Mulligan is co-author with her husband Ed McCarthy of the Wine for Dummies series of books. You can find Mary's picks of Portuguese wines on our website at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Oven Mitts That Talk at MIT, making lunch for the editor of Gourmet Magazine, the mother of all peppers, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and your family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. There's a particularly interesting research project going on at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Media Laboratory. Rumor has it that oven mitts are being trained to tell you whether the roast is done or not, and a kitchen counter has been developed that keeps track of your favorite recipes. That's the tip of the iceberg. The project is called Counterintelligence. Basically, this is a bunch of scientific geniuses planning the kitchens of the future. Joseph Kay is part of MIT's research team. Joseph, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. Hey.
So, Joseph, tell me, what's going on with this project?
Well, the big picture is that we're doing a kitchen of the future. We're looking at the future of the kitchen, the future of the home, the future of food, and we're looking at that in a whole bunch of different ways. We've got a couple of different projects working right now. We've got a project called Counterintelligence. What we're doing is projecting down on the counter. So there's plenty of space, there's plenty of room. We've got a thing called a capacitive array underneath, which basically makes the whole counter into a touch screen. So you can touch the different areas if you want to. You know, if it says something like, whip the eggs, and you don't know how to whip eggs, then you touch on whip eggs, and up comes a little video of Julia Child, hey, and this is how you whip eggs.
So you're saying overhead projection is projecting down on my counter. It's like watching a movie on my counter while I'm making dinner?
Exactly. We like projecting because you can get really big really easily. Nobody likes working on little 6-inch screens. And besides, when you start to project down on the counter, you can physically lay out your recipe. You know, you can do your sugar over here in this corner, you can do your mixing bowl in this corner, and that can be all part of the recipe.
So now then, the counter under the sugar will talk to me?
It does talk, yes. We originally designed this for kids, so it reads out the words whenever you touch the words. So you touch, you know, one cup of sugar, and it says, one cup of sugar. I had someone working for me who has this remarkable resemblance to a young Julia Child, well, voice-wise anyway. Or we also did it with a computer-generated voice, and nobody liked that at all, so we kind of threw that idea out the window.
Well, I don't think I want that in my kitchen. What else? What are some of the other projects?
We've got a project I'm really excited about right now called Instinct. And Instinct is an idea for connecting two spaces using smell. For example, kitchens. So imagine you walk into your kitchen and you smell ginger and nutmeg and cinnamon.
Ooh.
And you're like, oh, Mum's making gingerbread again. Now, your mother could be in, my mother is in Tokyo, for example, and so I don't get to smell her cooking, but that idea that you can still have the smell of the cooking coming even though you're not in the same room as them.
Well, why would you do this?
We're interested in thinking about what happens when you can communicate in different ways. Now with video conferencing and webcams, we're getting pretty good at transmitting video. And with the telephone, we've got pretty good at transmitting audio at a distance. And we're starting to explore the other senses. There's another group in my lab who's doing a project exploring doing touch at a distance. And we think that smell is a very big sense. And it's a very exciting area to explore. And it's something where there's not a lot of work that's been done on it yet. There are all these companies out there that are saying they're going to be releasing smell-producing devices in the next year or two. So we're going to stand there and say, okay, we think that smell is going to be very important. You can use it in this way, in this way, in this way. Because right now what's out there, people are talking about burning rubber smells for racing games, or gunpowder smells, you know, so you can walk around dungeons and strafe people and smell the gunpowder. We're kind of not very interested in that domain of application. We're thinking about how we can use it to increase communication.
Oh, so you're figuring real people day-to-day will be using this kind of thing.
I don't know. It's something we don't really think in terms of a product. We think in terms of an idea. I think really what's going on is we're exploring smell as a medium for communication, rather than saying this device as it stands will be used in people's kitchens.
But you're doing a lot of stuff that has to do with sort of like day-to-day cooking chores, right?
Yeah, and we have a sort of secret hidden agenda. We really like cooking. We really want more people to cook. And we're working on different ways for that to happen.
So we have the Instinct. What else is going on in this lab?
Well, we've got a project which we've really just finished up and sort of wrapped a red ribbon around, and that's called Mr. Java. And Mr. Java is kind of a coffee machine of the future. We took an existing coffee machine, we modified it so that it recognizes your mug. So I put my coffee cup under the spout and it gives me a double tall latte and the news from London. Other people put their cups under the spout and they get an espresso and the sports stalls for their favorite team. And I think that idea that you go somewhere, you use something, and it's already customized to you, this idea of mass customization, is, I think, huge and really relevant in a very big way to what's happening in the rest of the world.
How does that work? How does it know my cup wants that?
Well, what we've done is we've glued a thing called an RFID tag onto the bottom. An RFID tag is kind of think of it as a new kind of barcode.
Uh-huh.
It's a little computer chip with a little antenna on it. And what that means is that it just transmits an identifier. It says, I'm cup number 197462. And we can take that and we look that up in the database, and somewhere it says, cup number 197462 is Joe Fisher's cup, and he likes to drink double tall lattes and hear the news from London. And that very simple system gives you a huge amount of functionality and really changes the way that people deal with things.
Okay, how did this start?
Well, it was all a conversation. I was, as a sophomore at MIT, I was in a group with my advisor, Mike Hawley, and a whole bunch of freshmen, and we were putting different words together to see what would happen, and someone put the words intelligent and food in a sentence. We thought, intelligent food? That's kind of interesting. And we thought about all sorts of bad ideas for getting computers to identify food, and then came up with the realization that a lot of food already has a barcode on, so we can use that. So I built a PC... PC dinners. It's a barcode-enabled microwave. You mm-hmm. scan in the barcode, and you throw whatever it is in the microwave, and it cooks it for the appropriate length of time. And then just to make it a bit more interesting, we made it so it took the personality of whatever food you put in there. So you put in frozen Danish, and the Danish chef says, "Ja, please put the Danish in the microwave." And we had French toast, and oui, please put the French toast in the microwave, and a couple of others.
This sounds like something I would actually buy. So that's how. So then now it's become this very big project, I gather.
Yeah, we've got about 10 people working on it right now. Most of them undergrads. We've got 2 or 3 grad students who are on it. We've got, I think, 8 companies sponsoring us now.
Huh.
It's taken off in a big way, a lot bigger than I ever expected.
Now who do you go to for advice?
It's a good question. I mean, we talk with everyone from serious chefs. We've had Martha Stewart came by a few times. Julia Child came by. Jacques Pepin came by, along with Pierre Boisjoy. The chef that I enjoyed talking to the most is a guy called Jose Andreas at Haleo down in Washington, D.C. And he's just fabulous. He's hugely creative and really excited about the idea of technology. So we talk to them, but we also talk to companies like Kraft. We go and talk to their food scientists, go and talk to their researchers. There are 2 ethnographers, one's at Intel and one's at Motorola, and I talk to them a lot. Just trying to get an idea of the whole big picture.
Do you ever talk to kind of everyday people?
Informally, yes. And one of the things about working on kitchens as a researcher is that everyone knows what should happen. You know, if you're working on sort of ballistic rocket engines, no one ever comes up to you at parties and like, you know what we need in a ballistic rocket engine? But if you're working on smart kitchens, everyone comes up to you and they have the same list of things that they want you to build.
I'll bet you the thing you hear at parties most from people, everyday cooks or people who just wrestle with getting in and out of the kitchen is, can you come up with a kitchen that cleans itself?
Yes, that's right.
Is that the most often asked question?
We get that all the time.
Joseph, thank you.
A pleasure.
Joseph Kay is a member of the team researching the kitchen of the future at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We all know that nervous feeling you get when you've invited someone to a meal who you really want to impress. Well, reporter Scott Haas is a real glutton for punishment. He invited Ruth Reichel over for lunch. Ruth is the editor of Gourmet Magazine. Before that, she was one of the most powerful restaurant critics in the country, reviewing for the New York Times. Scott has quite a tale to tell.
This is Scott Haas. When I heard that Ruth Reichel, the former New York Times restaurant critic and now the editor of Gourmet Magazine, was going to be in Boston, I thought to myself, I'd like to introduce her to food in Boston, the place where I dine the most, my home. And I decided I would make something simple. Terrific 8-hour lamb stew, lamb shoulder. It's called lamb you can eat with a spoon, white beans, chervil, morels, and fava beans, and we'd see what happened. I told myself there's nothing to worry about after all. I mean, what's the worst that's going to happen? She's going to hate the food. She's going to take away 3 of my 4 stars. But in the end, I found that I really was very anxious about what she would think of my food. I mean, here's this person who eats food in restaurants for a living coming to my home and critiquing my food. Why did I do this to myself? What was I thinking? I wonder who that could be. I'm going to have to answer it. Hello? Uh-huh. Hi, Ruth. You're coming a half hour early. No, that's no problem. That's great. Terrific. Yeah, sure. No problem. See you then. Ruth has just phoned and said she's called from her car phone. And she's a half hour early. I am not ready for her to come in here. I have still to make the potato chips. But I'm sure it'll be fine. And I'm sure that when she comes here, I will be a model of a poise. And I will certainly, I'm already in over my head at this point. It should just be a fun lunch. It's going to be a fun lunch. I mean, it'll just be fun.
I'm Ruth Reichel. I'm here in Boston on a tour for my book, Tender at the Bone.
Ruth, I can't help noticing that you don't seem to be in disguise.
No, I'm only doing radio at the moment. I don't need to be in disguise on the radio.
Now, sometimes, despite the fact that you're wearing these disguises, you are, I suppose, noticed in a restaurant?
Yeah, and there's no way to feel more stupid than to be dolled up as a frumpy old lady or a blonde siren and have... You see the people in the kitchen, they're peering through the door, and you know that they are just laughing and giggling and thinking what a fool you are.
What, does something change when they figure out that you're there?
First, there's the wouldn't you like a better table ploy. The other thing is when there's a huge wait between courses, you know that the chef is back there rejecting one failure after another because he wants the perfect dish. This is really foolish because after a while you get really irritated. You just want your food. The other thing is that you suddenly notice that your waiter isn't waiting on any of the tables around you. You have a dedicated waiter whose only job is to make sure that you are happy. Actually, Joe Baum, who was a great restaurateur, once gave his staff the best advice I've ever heard, which is when you see a critic in the room, ignore them completely. Just pretend they're an ordinary person, but make sure that all the people around them get exceptional service.
Oh, that's very funny. That's a great idea.
It's a great idea.
Would you like to try some food here?
I'd love some.
I'm willing to give it a try here, and I'm not in the least. I'm not worried at all about the reaction that you're going to have to the food.
Oh, good. I'm
not worried. No,
I'm glad.
Not,
you shouldn't be worried.
Not concerned.
Don't be concerned.
Not
at
me.
All.
No.
Yeah.
So we're eating these this appetizer now. Do you want me to tell you what you want to guess what it is? Do you want to tell me what it is, or should I not put you on the spot? Or?
Well, these are obviously potatoes.
That's right. Those are potatoes. That's right.
So the question is, are they supposed to be crisp like this,
mm-hmm.
or not crisp like the first one I ate?
I see. Well, well. Plates. Ruth is helping me by moving the plates, so...
I want to know, are we getting these morels?
They were hidden in the closet, but yes, you're getting the morels.
I'm getting out of the kitchen because timing is everything.
I'm going to open the oven now and take out the main course here. Oh, it looks pretty good. It's a slow-braised lamb shoulder. It's called lamb you can eat with a spoon. Now, we should give the best cut of the lamb and the best white beans to the restaurant critic.
know that she's Chris because she got in disguise?
The wine?
Oh, it's a 1982, which was one of the great vintages of the century.
It doesn't really matter where anyone sits. Sit wherever you like, except for over here, because that's where Ruth's sitting, because that happens to be the better cut of lamb.
Oh, I'm getting the special one.
You're getting the special one. Which one's yours?
I'm getting the one with the most amount of lamb.
No. It's just the nicest. They're all the same.
Yeah, no, this is just like being in a restaurant. Scott, I know that normally when guests come over, you give them peanut butter and jelly, right? And lemonade.
No, this is our traditional Friday lunch. You just happen to luck out. I will not hover over you while you eat this food. I won't ask you anything about it. Just enjoy it.
Everything needs salt, so I'm going to bring the salt to the table.
So, I just never put salt and pepper on the table when I have friends over for dinner because I figure I've done it right. So,
I have to tell you, I hate chefs who do that.
All right. Yeah, I do too, actually. I think you're right.
You know, the morels don't have much taste, though, because they're dried morels. You know what I mean? Like, you want a fresh morel that sings and.
Scott, are you making excuses?
No.
And this is delicious.
Really?
Had your meal here, and would you come back? I mean, was it adequate, or what do you think?
Well, I have to tell you, I think the food was really superb.
The food
was great. No, the service though was a little tentative.
A little nervous.
So I would say 4-star food, 2-star service.
So that gives us 6 stars.
Wow, that's incredible.
No, I think we averaged them out.
Excuse me.
What a first-year bubble.
All right. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed the food. You're welcome here anytime.
This piece was produced by Scott Haas and John Marston. Well, it's time for the trivia question of the week. Now, this is the part of the show where we try to challenge your knowledge of the arcane, fascinating, or of just plain useless bits of food lore. This week's question was inspired by something I'd like in my kitchen of the future. A deep fryer that cleans up after itself. And it would be for my favorite Sunday treat, homemade donuts. Now, historically, donuts were round balls. So this week's trivia question is, how did the donut get a hole? We'll have that answer in a moment. We'll learn about the mother of all chili peppers, and we'll get to your calls. So get to those phones, folks. The number is 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. But before we do that, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question was based on the fact that historically the donut was a round ball. So the big query is,
how did the donut get a hole? Well, supposedly it was a sea captain from Camden, Maine. His name was Hanson Gregory. The people in Camden have even erected a 28-foot statue of Captain Gregory, commemorating his genius for creating something that isn't there, a hole. Now, this little tidbit came from a new book called Offbeat Food by Alan Ridenour. He says the way this hole thing got started was during a storm at sea. It seems the captain was eating a chunk of cake, a wave threw him against the ship's wheel, and accidentally the cake was impaled on one of the wheel's handles. So from then on, the captain insisted his cakes be baked with a hole in the middle so that he could thread them onto the handles of the wheel while he steered the boat. Supposedly then the idea spread to fried donuts. If you ask me, this is pretty far-fetched, but there was something in the book that was really intriguing about donuts. You've probably heard of the stirring speech John F. Kennedy made in Berlin in 1963. Now, you have to imagine the setting. JFK is standing at the Berlin Wall in West Berlin. Now, at that time, West Berlin was like a tiny island of democracy surrounded by communist-controlled East Germany. Kennedy said in his speech, quote, "All free men, wherever they may live, are citizens of Berlin, and therefore, as a free man, I take pride in the words," and please excuse my German for this, "Ich bin ein Berliner," meaning to say, "I am a Berliner." But Kennedy made a grammatical error. If you literally translate what he said, "I am a jelly donut." Ein Berliner is a German jelly donut, because in German, the indefinite article, ein in this case, is never used before citizenships or nationalities. What Kennedy meant to say was, "Ich bin Berliner," with no ein. Well, it's obvious that no one cared about the era. The speech was applauded around the world. And that's all I have to say about donuts. For now. Lines are officially open for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. We will take a shot at anything you want to talk about. Let's get right to the phones. We have Arthur on the line. So, Arthur, what do you want to talk about?
I work and I live at home.
Uh-huh.
And I cook for myself. And I like to cook food that I can use later without having to, you know, set up the kitchen and break it down every single day.
Yeah, I know what that's like.
Yeah, so I cook large portions of things like stews and soups, but I'm never sure about the storage.
Yeah. And you're talking about cooked food generally.
Generally, yeah.
I think there's some basic guidelines here. If it's cooked, I think always play it safe. If you're going to keep it in the fridge, figure 3 days max.
Okay.
If it has seafood in it, figure a day maximum two.
Oh, you know, I'll be cooking fish today.
Well, okay, but now that doesn't mean you can't freeze this stuff. And with the freezing, the key is how you package it, really, because you either want to put it in something, you know, a heavy container or those Ziploc bags that are heavy-duty freezer bags,
mm-hmm.
and press all the air out and do them in portions, which you're probably already doing. And I always figure that it works something like this, that for cooked food, you figure 3 to 6 months.
That would be anything in poultry
almost,
as well?
Almost,
fish.
Yeah, almost anything.
Three to six months?
Yeah, 3 to 6 months, and I usually always lean closer to 3 months. And then again, we have the back of the freezer, the unexcavated part of the freezer. I actually just found a container of broth in there that was dated 1995.
And, oh, my.
Yeah, well, I'm going to go on the Antiques Roadshow with it.
I mean, it does get away from you. Always label your containers. At least so you have an idea of when you put them in there. Just put the date and what everything is.
Yeah, I do label things.
Good.
And how about when you're freezing raw fish, for instance, in the freezer?
When you're freezing raw fish, wrap it really well or seal it really well. Make sure it's really packed. And there, I think it's in its prime for about 3 months.
Okay.
Okay?
Hey, thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Speaking of freezing, I was thinking about tomatoes. I mean, this is the time of year that everybody starts to can them. Well, did you know that you can freeze tomatoes? It's really easy. All you have to do is remove the core, stuff them into a heavy plastic bag, get all the air out, seal it, and put them in the freezer. I've been doing this for years, but this is the thing that our technical director, Jenny Lubke, came up with. She said, why not add some chopped onion, garlic, and fresh basil to the bags? That way, you can have instant sauces or instant soup. Now, to make the sauce, all you do is maybe saute some more onion and garlic, and then just drop the frozen stuff into the pot and let it cook. And if you want to make a soup, dump the stuff into a pot, add broth, cook it for 15, 20 minutes, and you've got tomato soup. Okay, let's get back to the phones. We've got John on the line. So, John, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I sent you an email a while back concerning how much I like your show. I pick you up from time to time in different cities. I'm an over-the-road truck driver.
You're the truck driver. I remember your email. It was neat. We never hear from truckers.
Oh, it's because we're out here driving too much.
This is the deal, huh? Oh, wait, you've got a question? Because I've got one for you.
Oh, well, my question was mainly concerning that last call actually kind of answered some of the questions concerning how long I could keep food in the fridge, because I keep a cooler in my truck just due to the amount of traveling I do, but I'm only out 3-4 days at a time. So he answered a few questions.
You mean how long you can keep stuff in that cooler?
Yeah.
Essentially?
Yeah.
You know, generally the rule of thumb there is very similar to what I just said to our other caller about the idea that you've got probably 3 days to 4 days if it's really chilled and cold. But, you know, there's stuff you could take with you that you don't necessarily have to refrigerate.
Yeah, I've been specializing in the canned food department, which...
I'm not thinking about that.
It's unimaginative, but it travels well.
Well, I understand that. But you could keep for a minimum of at least a day, probably a little bit longer, things like, you know, raw celery, raw carrots, raw cauliflower.
Well, sure, I carry some of those. I've found out that bananas do not travel well. The vibration of a truck will shake a banana into a black goo in about a day.
I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah. Trucks have quite a bit of vibration in them. And that's a factor I consider in taking a lot of foods with me.
That's really interesting. The other thing is dried fruit. Great for snacking. You know, it's meant to last forever without any kind of refrigeration.
Oh, yes. Dried apricots are a favorite.
Yeah, exactly. And then maybe when you stop, I mean, I gather you like to cater your own meals sometimes.
Sometimes. I mean, I'm out here on the road, and truck stop food is pretty much the same wherever you go. I mean, you really have to look for it to find one that stands out.
See, that was going to be my question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, no, we always hear about great truck stop foods that if you want to eat well on the road, go to where the truckers are. This isn't true?
To a certain extent. I mean, there are some large, like, I'm in a truck stop here in northern Illinois, and the food here is almost exactly the same as you can get at the same truck stop in Southern California. And, this particular chain is a pretty good one, but there are other ones which I avoid intentionally.
Yeah.
They're well known that their food is no good coast to coast.
So and you're not going to see truckers there?
Yes, but out of necessity.
Yeah. Because, all right, so do you actually make your own meals on the road sometimes? And
I would like to start. I'm just now on this on a dedicated run where I know where I'm going each week.
Mm-hmm.
I know when I'll be back, and I know how long I'll be gone in the meantime. So I would like to start carrying my own food, and I've just wanted to bounce a few ideas off you, see what you would recommend.
I think one of the things is think about the roasted chicken. It'll last you for a whole day, half of a roasted chicken, in that cooler.
Okay.
Think about those raw vegetables. And then one of the other things that might be a good idea, if you can stop at a market, buy those packaged organic salad greens. They're pre-washed. and you could throw them, just have a nice big bowl, throw them into the bowl, add some of that cold chicken, make your own dressing from your oil and vinegar. Oil and vinegar never spoils, you know, in a truck. And you can add what, you could add a little mustard to that dressing. You could chop garlic into it. Have a condiment pack. Good olive oil, good vinegar, salt and pepper, soy sauce, hot sauce, because whenever you're in doubt, you know, my theory is put hot sauce on it. It's got to be better.
Oh, yes. I have little bottles of Tabasco everywhere in my truck.
Well, there you go. You see, I mean, we're in the same mindset here. But the reality is, if you can keep that chicken cold, it's delicious. It's just delicious. And you have a nice big green salad with lots of raw veggies in it. So that can kind of be like night one on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, what you can do is say, okay, what can I pick up as I go along? Like, do you have a great bakery maybe on this dedicated run that you can go to?
I got to dig a little bit for it, but yeah, they're out there.
Keep bread around. Get some good cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Get a couple of tomatoes and some fruit. Also, the bread is the kind of thing you could stock up on it, break it up into chunks, freeze it into small packages, because bread freezes really well, and then you can even stick that frozen bread right in the cooler. It'll defrost over the day or two, and you'll have it.
That is a great idea.
Yeah, and good whole grain bread with some good cheese and good fruit.
Ooh, that sounds good.
Yeah.
I never really thought of that. I mean, I've been eating, you know, Cafe Americana for so long out here. It's been, you know, just kind of slipped my mind. But back to your salad for a minute. I got a really good Dijon recipe from my mom for a good vinaigrette.
Oh, great.
And the good thing about the vibration is that it will keep it more or less mixed.
Sounds like you come from a family of great cooks.
Oh, yeah. Yes, Middle Eastern. Well, my parents were world travelers, and growing up, we ate food from all around the world every night at the dinner table. And it was, you know, good, wholesome, different, and cheap.
Well, and you know, that's the other thing, isn't it true? You know, most people don't realize how cheap it can be.
Oh, yeah.
And it really can. John, thank you, and enjoy. And when we see trucks going by, we'll wave. Maybe one of them will be you.
Probably. All right, thank you very much, Lynn.
Hey, thank you for calling.
All right, thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
We just read that the Coronado National Forest in Tucson, Arizona, has set aside 2,500 acres for a chili. Well, the logical question here is why? And to answer it, we've gotten on the phone Gail Ashenbrenner, who is the National Forest's Public Relations Officer. Gail, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Gail, why 2,500 acres for chili? Are you guys going into the chili canning business?
No, we're not. But these chilies are special. These are little chiltepines, wild chilies that we believe to be the mother of all chili peppers.
You mean these are the peppers that all the other chilies came from?
Yes, as a matter of fact, and we can tell that genetically. And one of the reasons that we have set aside this wild chili botanical area is to conserve and to study the chilies in their native habitat.
So they are native to Tucson, Arizona?
Well, actually, the chilies can be found in different parts in the world. There's quite a few in Mexico, but here in southern Arizona, this is the northernmost part of their range. And so in that reason, we believe that these chilies may have some special genes that could be very important in research and the cultivation of domestic crops of chili.
Huh. So what are these little chilipin, is that how you pronounce it?
Chiltepines.
Chiltepine chilies. What do they look like?
Oh, they're tiny. The little plants grow under nurse plants. They're protected from the very harsh conditions here in the desert, and they have a little flower on them, and they fruit in the fall. The fall fruits are small and red, and when they're dried, they look a lot like dried peas, just about that small.
So they're very tiny, and they're round.
They're very tiny, they're round, but they are loaded with the active ingredient capsaicin, which is the element that makes chilies hot.
How hot are they?
They are very hot. As a matter of fact, the heat in green peppers and other kinds of peppers, as well as red peppers, are measured in Scoville units.
Right, yeah.
Jalapenos usually range from about 1 to 10,000. These chiltepines are rated at 75,000 Scoville units. They are very, very hot.
Oh, those are scalding.
Yes, they are.
Now, you said they're very tiny and they grow under a nurse plant. What's a nurse plant?
Well, these chilies are growing in the high Sonoran Desert. They're growing at about 3,000 feet. And so while the days are very hot and they're exposed to extreme drought and heat, the nights can be very cold. And we have found in this special area that most of the chili plants grow underneath shrubs and bushes. And the reason for that is how they're dispersed. Some birds like these chilies better than even berries. And where the birds hang out and defecate is where the chilies are replanted. So the birds are really cultivating our chili plants for us.
You know, I remember reading some wonderful material from the botanist Gary Nabhan, and he talks about that, you know, this is one of the ancient ways that seeds are dispersed. An animal eats something, then an animal defecates, and that's how you get seeds in other places.
Yes, and it might be easier for nature to actually repropagate these plants than us, because the chilies take some maturing, some actual processing before that they can sprout. But through the bird's digestive tract, they're doing that already. And so the birds do tend to be the natural chili gardeners.
Gail, thank you.
You're welcome.
That was Gail Ashenbrenner, Public Affairs Officer at the Coronado National Forest in Tucson, Arizona. You can find information on getting dried chiltepín chilies or seeds that you could plant on our website at splendidtable.org. Well, that's all we have time for this week. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Have a great week. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with an old saying from the French statesman and nobleman, Talleyrand. He said, England has three sauces and 360 religions, whereas France has three religions, but 360 sauces. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the only place you can register for kitchen essentials, 1810 stainless steel cookware from Calphalon. It's professional style heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Jennifer Russell and Sally Swift. Our associate producer is Jennifer Lubke. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Radio International.